Today's broadcast was originally recorded on January 25th, 2023.
We're working with these state legislators to make sure they have all of the information they need to draft the bills. In some cases, we actually draft them for them. Iowa was the first state that we got to work in, and we did it quickly and we did it quietly. Honestly, nobody noticed.
Well, guess what? Now we've noticed.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. Glad to have you with us here. That quote at the top of the program, that woman you heard, that was a woman named Jessica Anderson. She's the executive director of the Heritage Foundation's so-called Heritage Action Fund. I'll play a little bit more of her later, but that was her basically boasting to a bunch of wealthy donors how her group is undermining democracy in states around the country by literally writing voter suppression bills for Republican state lawmakers that they are then supposed to present and propose as if they are their own bills, often pretending that they are popular grassroots initiatives, when actually they come from the Heritage Foundation. All of this in critical presidential swing states around the country. This scheme has been underway by Heritage Action since at least the 2020 election, when Donald Trump pretended there was massive voter fraud, and these bills are being presented now as a response to those false claims. Oh, even if there wasn't massive voter fraud, voters think there were, so we have to do something about it by making it more difficult to vote, etc., at least for, you know, certain people. Anyway, now the good folks at Documented.net, a good government watchdog and investigative reporting outfit, the ones who unearthed that video of Anderson addressing funders at a private conference in 2021, the folks at Documented have begun piecing together the funding for this grotesque initiative, and it's kind of jaw-dropping. This is an effort by dark money groups who are now spending tens of millions of dollars to adopt these voter suppression laws in states like, as you heard, Iowa, Georgia, Arizona, and elsewhere. We'll be joined momentarily by Brendan Fisher, one of the nation's top campaign finance experts who now works at Documented, to explain this obscene effort and what, if anything, can be done in response to it. And I also want to ask him about this new story just out yesterday from the Daily Beast's Roger Sullenberger on George Santos. Now, we haven't covered Santos all that much on this program. Desi Doyen, have we even mentioned him at all? Maybe once or twice?
Yeah. I mean, he seems to be, his lies seem to be well covered pretty much everywhere.
Correct.
Else. But we haven't, we've only, I think, referenced him in passing mostly.
I'm sure you know, Republican congressman from New York, freshman. He's getting plenty of coverage for all of these extraordinary lies about pretty much every single aspect of his life that he ran on to become a U.S. congressman last November, from lying about, you know, which schools he went to or didn't go to where he worked or didn't, to his lies about his own family escaping the Holocaust and his mother who was killed on 9/11, even though she actually wasn't. Anyway, it's all lies, all of it. And frankly, House Republicans do not seem to care in the least. Kevin McCarthy has now seated him on committees in Congress because, frankly, they've got such a slim majority in the House that McCarthy has decided they need him there. So for now, he's staying. But because Santos is being covered so much elsewhere, and because, frankly, lying about one's life when running for Congress isn't actually in and of itself unlawful.
But it is on brand for Republicans.
Well, it is. So anyway, I haven't had much to say or add about this idiocy, but lying about money in your campaign actually is unlawful. And on that, Roger Sullenberger at The Daily Beast detailed some new news that should get the attention, I would hope, of law enforcement officials if they aren't already paying attention. According to Sullenberger, late Tuesday afternoon, George Santos's political operation filed a flurry of amended campaign finance reports telling the feds, among other things, that a $500,000 loan that he gave to his campaign didn't, in fact, come from his personal funds, as he had previously claimed. However, writes Sullenberger, while the newly amended filing told us where the funds did not come from, it also raised a new question. Where did the money come from? While both the old and new campaign filings claim that the loans came, quote, from the candidate, the campaign's previously most recently amended filings had ticked the box for, quote, personal funds of the candidate. But on the newly amended filings on Tuesday, that box is now unchecked. Now, you're allowed to give largely as much money as you want to your own campaign. Everyone else who wants to donate has to stick to very specific limits, which are much, much lower. No single person other than the candidate can give him or herself $500,000 directly, to a campaign for the U.S. House. So if Santos didn't give that money to himself, to his own campaign as a loan, then who did? Now, another amended filing on Tuesday, as Sullenberger documents, disclosed that $125,000, quote, loan from the candidate in late October also did not come from his personal funds. But like the $500,000 question, Santos did not say where that money actually came from, when the loan was due, or what entity, if any, had backed the money. If it was actually, for example, a bank loan that he took out to give to his own campaign. Now, in total, Santos supposedly loaned his campaign about $700,000 this way, that he's now sort of being forced to admit was not actually his own money. But whose was it? And it's not a surprise, that he lied about this, but it is a surprise that there was $700,000 that he even had access to loan in the first place. When he unsuccessfully ran for the House 2 years earlier, he claimed to only make about $50,000 a year. So how did he even have access to $700,000 to loan to his campaign last year? Now, as Josh Marshall of TPM notes today, citing Sullenberger's report, quote, at the center of the Santos story from the beginning has been the question of how he went from being a chronic deadbeat making $50,000 a year in 2020 to making millions just 2 years later from his personal company, the DeVolder Organization, which is where he claims this $700,000 came from, or at least he originally made that claim. He made so much that he could loan his campaign almost $750,000, writes Josh. Well, now we may finally have an answer. That money he loaned his campaign, well, it wasn't actually his money. He then goes on to cite Sullenberger's report, but notes that's not how this works. If you loan your money, if you loan money to your campaign, it has to be your money. If it's not your money, it's not you loaning money to the campaign. Critically, because it's not your money, you cannot loan or donate unlimited funds to your campaign. Josh writes, if I'm George and some pals want to give me money so I can donate or loan it, same difference, to my campaign, that's treated as a donation from the pal to the campaign. And all the hard money campaign finance limits apply, like $2,500 per election, I think is what it is now. $2,500 is a lot different than $700,000. So as Josh notes, Santos now seems to be saying that he was a straw donor to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars to his own campaign. Of course, straw donations are illegal. And, you know, so if I'm a millionaire, for example, I can't give $2,500 to a whole bunch of people or even to one person and ask them to donate that to a campaign. I can't hide the fact that I'm the one actually giving the money, that I violated the limit on how much money I'm allowed to give to a campaign by, you know, giving it to a bunch of other people to give in their name. That is illegal. So if the money was not Santos's personal money, since only the candidate him or herself is allowed to give more money to the campaign than allowed by campaign finance limits, whose money was it? Because it sure does not sound lawful at all. As Josh writes, both these new forms and, for that matter, Santos himself are so absurd that I guess we can't completely rule out the possibility that it's a clerical error, that they just inadvertently forgot to check that box this time. As he notes, that seems basically preposterous, but he can't totally rule it out because he seems to be admitting to several major crimes in this new filing, George Santos does. He notes, Marshall notes, campaign reports get amended all the time, but at this scale, with this level of deception, I don't think you can just refile it this way and make it fine any more than you're off the hook for robbery if you just give the money back once you get caught. It's a major infraction. Now, Sullenberger's report at Daily Beast also quotes my guest, who is joining me shortly, Brendan Fisher, on all of this because, as I note, he's one of the nation's top campaign finance people, with Brendan explaining, quote, I don't know what they think they were doing. Santos's campaign might have unchecked the box for personal funds of candidate, but it's still reporting that the money came from Santos himself. If the, quote, loan from candidate didn't actually come from the candidate, then Santos should come clean and disclose where the money came from. Santos can't just uncheck a box and make his legal problems go away. All of which raises a question that I have quietly wondered about since this story of Santos loaning his campaign $700,000 first came to light. I don't think I've discussed it on the show, in part because it seems so absurd. But did anybody actually loan the Senate the Santos campaign $700,000, or did Santos just claim that he did? Originally it was him, now we don't know who. But was there actually $700,000 loaned to the campaign at all? Now, why would he lie about that? Well, for one, he was trying to make himself out to be a big shot, a successful real estate and finance guy, a la Donald Trump, his heroes, with, you know, false claims about working for big banks and owning properties through his family business when he actually didn't. But also, you may recall last year, Texas Senator Ted Cruz actually won a case at the U.S. Supreme Court. Yes, our corrupted and stolen U.S. Supreme Court. When Cruz argued that personal loans made by candidates to their own campaigns can actually be paid back after the election by other people. Now, that seems ridiculous on its face. But as we discussed at the time, Ted Cruz actually got away with this argument at the U.S. Supreme Court, for crying out loud. So he can now loan, and any candidate can loan their own campaigns, let's say $1 million. And then after they win the campaign, after they win the election, other people like donors and lobbyists, et cetera, can actually give Ted Cruz money to help pay off the loans that he himself made to his own campaign.
In other words, after the fact, those donors can do exactly that, and the candidate can make money off of it.
Exactly. So once they're in office, you can give money to an elected official, which would otherwise be, you know, a bribe.
As long as you say that it's to pay back this campaign loan,
exactly.
Then hey, it's all right.
So you can make tons of money this way, actually. It's a way to apparently lawfully now take payoffs from anyone you like after you are in office, which is bad enough. But given who we're talking about here, con man George Santos, I'm wondering if there was actually any money that anyone loaned his campaign, or if it was all just a paper filing so that he could later, if he won the election, actually, you know, get other people to give him that money, give him that $700,000. Which I know sounds absolutely insane. And that's one of the reasons I have not raised it here, because I'm sure it's wrong and I'm sure that this stuff gets tracked. And if a candidate says he gave $700,000 to his own campaign,
somebody looks at that and double checks it happened.
Well, we may not know where it came from, but surely they know that they actually gave $700,000 to their own campaign, right? So, yeah. It all sounds insane. My theory, I admit it, it's ridiculous, but it is George Santos we're talking about here. So anyway, as long as I'll be joined by Brendan Fisher to discuss, as planned, the critical sunlight that his organization is now bringing to the obscene multi-million-dollar effort by Heritage Foundation to attack and undermine American elections and democracy itself, I will try to leave some time to see if Brendan has any thoughts on my admittedly insane, couldn't possibly be true, couldn't possibly be the case, theory about George Santos. Okay, all of that is straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks. All that glitters isn't gold. No, it's not. All that glitters isn't gold. Sometimes it's sunshine. All that glitters, glitters, glitters. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Longtime bradblog.com readers and Bradcast listeners will likely recognize the name Paul Weyrich. He was the revered far-right godfather of modern-day so-called conservative Republican politics. In 1973, he helped form the Heritage Foundation, a right-wing think tank that has, for decades, held outsized power to influence Republicans and Republican policy in Washington, D.C. Back in 1980, at a convention of evangelical Christians in, I think it was Texas, where the then presidential candidate Ronald Reagan was also a speaker, Weyrich famously said the quiet part out loud regarding how folks on the right hope to win elections not by, you know, holding popular positions, but by preventing their opponents from being able to cast a vote at all.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Our leverage in the elections goes up as the voting populace goes down. That was Paul Weyrich, founder of the Heritage Foundation back in 1980. And though most Republicans since then have tried to sort of pretend that they have no actual interest in voter suppression, well, that classic statement from Heritage Foundation's founder has really been the touchstone for GOP election laws and attempted voting restrictions in the, 50 or so years since. And in recent years, the Heritage Foundation has been taking a more direct role in pushing for voting restrictions around the country. Since the 2020 election, as the investigative journalists and good government experts at documented.net have been exposing and reporting recently, Heritage has doubled and frankly tripled down on those efforts big time. As reported at The Guardian earlier this month, the advocacy arm of the far-right Heritage Foundation, the powerful right-wing think tank based in Washington, D.C., spent more than $5 million on lobbying in 2021 as it worked to block federal voting rights legislation and advance an ambitious plan to spread its far-right agenda calling for aggressive voter suppression measures in battleground states. Previously unreported 2021 tax filings from Heritage Action for America, which operates as the foundation's activist wing, shows that it spent more than $5 million on contracting outside lobbying services. That outlay comes on top of more than $500,000 that the group invested in its own in-house federal lobbying efforts that same year, as well as registered lobbying by Heritage Action staffers in at least 24 states. The tax filing documenting this spending was obtained by the government transparency watchdog group Documented and was shared with The Guardian. It points to the pivotal role that Heritage Action is increasingly playing in shaping the rules that govern U.S. democracy itself. The efforts help explain the unprecedented tidal wave of restrictive voting laws that we have seen spread across Republican-controlled states in the wake of the 2020 presidential election. As the Brennan Center has reported, more voter suppression laws were passed in 2021 in the wake of Donald Trump's evidence-free claims of massive voter fraud against him than in any year since the Brennan Center began monitoring voting legislation more than a decade ago. Yes, we have seen a virtual tidal wave of restrictions on voting since the last presidential election, the one in which nobody has been able to actually find any substantive problems, systemic or otherwise, that adversely affected the election. That is, unless you consider Republican candidates losing some elections to be a substantive problem requiring changes to voting laws and access to the ballot box. The recently uncovered expenditures by Heritage also signals a dramatic increase in Heritage Action's advocacy activities, The Guardian writes. In 2020, Heritage Action had reported no spending at all on outside lobbying. Nonetheless, the next year they began investing millions. Why? And whose money was it? Heritage Action, their board includes the Republican mega donor Rebecca Mercer. And it is set up as a 501c4 nonprofit under the U.S. tax code, which exempts it from paying federal taxes at all. The group operates as a dark money group, avoiding disclosing the full sources of its total annual revenue, which is more than $18 million. In the past 2 years, as noted by The Guardian, the organization, through its public messaging, has echoed Trump's lies that U.S. elections are marked by rampant fraud. A private plan prepared last year by Heritage Action, ironically titled as its Election Integrity Plan, set out a 2-year, $24 million strategy. That plan was obtained by Documented, and it proposed a 2-prong approach that would work to block moves by Democrats in Congress to bolster voting rights while at the same time pressing Republican-controlled states to impose restrictions on the ballot box. The 4-page plan, which I will link to when we post today's program, It notes, quote, where Democrats hold power, we must defend against bad policy. Where conservatives and our allies are in power, we must advance changes that protect the lawful votes of Americans. Well, that sounds fine, I guess. The Heritage Action Plan was published by The Guardian along with this article for the first time. And part of the two-year strategy is to promote what it calls model election laws, focusing initially on eight battleground states. That would be Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Iowa, Michigan, Nevada, Texas, and Wisconsin. Now, model election laws sounds a hell of a lot like the so-called model laws that have been long produced by the right-wing American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which we have reported on in years past, as they have successfully made so-called model laws on just about everything that GOPers and, frankly, corporations wish to push into law. They've made these model laws, so-called model laws, available for state lawmakers to copy and paste and introduce back home at their state legislatures. Is there any non-right-wing equivalent of this? Should there be? I will ask my guest about that momentarily. But as reported by Mother Jones's Ari Berman and documented's Nick Sergey back in 2021, before the amount of dark money pouring into this program had now become clear, during a private meeting with donors in Tucson, Arizona in 2021, Heritage Action's executive director, a woman by the name of Jessica Anderson, she boasted about the role that her group had played in pressing Republican-controlled state legislatures to impose these new strict restrictions on voting, including limiting mail-in voting and early voting days, etc. And this was all done in the wake of the 2020 elections. In a video of that meeting obtained by Documented, Anderson told the donors that the group acted, quote, quickly and quietly in states like Iowa and Georgia to pass voting restrictions right after the 2020 election, boasting that, quote, nobody noticed their behind-the-scenes influence.
We're working with these state legislators to make sure they have all of the information they need to draft the bills. In some cases, we actually draft them for them, or we have a sentinel on our behalf, give them the model legislation. So it has that grassroots, you know, from the bottom up type of vibe. Iowa was the first state that we got to work in, and we did it quickly and we did it quietly. Honestly, nobody noticed. At the end of the day, the bill that Governor Kemp signed and the Georgia legislature marshaled through had eight key provisions that Heritage recommended. I had one message for him. Do not wait to sign that bill. If you wait even an hour, you will look weak. This bill needs to be signed immediately. The state legislature in Georgia got it done, and you can help own this and cheerlead this if you sign it quickly. Do not delay.
So that was Jessica Anderson, the executive director of Heritage Action, boasting that, oh, we actually drafted the bills for them, for the states, these voter suppression bills, you know, so that it has that grassroots type of bottom-up vibe. Not only are they not embarrassed, they're actually proud of this effort to make it more difficult to keep voters from voting. And their founder, their now late founder, Paul Weyrich, well, he said it more than 40 years ago, of course.
As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Heritage Action. According to the report at The Guardian, a report written by The Guardian's Ed Pilkington and Documented's Brendan Fisher, they note that their group has now registered to lobby in at least two dozen states across the country. There will be more, not less of this, most likely. Joining us now is Brendan Fisher, an old friend of the show who, after many years at the Campaign Legal Center, is now Deputy Executive Director at Documented.net, an investigative watchdog and journalism project committed to holding the powerful interests that undermine our democracy accountable. That sounds helpful. Brendan Fisher, it has been a while, sir, but welcome back to the broadcast, my friend.
Thank you for having me.
This spending of millions of dollars by Heritage Foundation on their lobbying efforts in 2021, why are we only finding out about it now? in 2023? Is it because it's something that you guys were only just able to find, or is it because the reporting requirements allow them to take this long before actually filing any actual financial statements?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. So one is that as a dark money group, Heritage Action and Heritage Foundation need not disclose where their money is coming from, or in most cases, where that money is going.
Mm-hmm.
The only limited transparency we get into Heritage Action fundraising and spending comes about a year and a half later when it files its annual tax return. So Heritage Action's 2021 tax return was filed late last year, and we reviewed it, and we're able to identify the $5.1 million spent on outside lobbyists in 2021 as the group pushed restrictive voting bills at the state level and were pushed to block voting rights legislation at the federal level.
Should that reporting requirement be changed in some way? Can it be changed? And if it was, as someone who's been covering campaign finance for so many years now, would it even help the public as you see it? Because it kind of feels at this point, Brendan, there are so many, you know, millions and frankly now billions sort of sloshing around in both our electoral and political systems at this point. I'm not sure that the public even cares at this point, even if we did know about it earlier. It kind of feels like many have just sort of thrown their hands up, although maybe that's the point.
Yeah, it's a great question. Certainly something like tax filings could be made public earlier.
Mm-hmm.
These groups have to file their tax returns based on the prior year, almost a year later.
Mm-hmm.
They can get their books together and review their finances in time to provide, something a little bit closer to real-time transparency to the public. And that's not going to provide a complete picture, but it provides details that, watchdog groups and journalists can use to help, piece together a bigger picture of how money is being spent, where some of these restrictive voting bills are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
But it does hint at, touch at a much bigger issue of, the lack of transparency around fundraising and spending in our political system, and that's something that Heritage Action in particular has worked to maintain, I should say.
Yeah,
it's worked to thwart legislation that would shine a spotlight on dark money.
I think you meant to say has worked to exploit, and I don't know if it's anything unlawful, but they have certainly taken advantage of it. As you note at The Guardian, it's not the only lobbying where these folks are. It's not only the lobbying effort specifically where these folks are just pouring in money at this point to try to affect state lawmaking and, most troubling, democracy itself. Here, you and Ed Pilkington note that in 2021, the Heritage Action organization reported paying more than $6 million to outside contractors for marketing and advertising. As I understand it, that's on top of the lobbying, and it's a sharp rise from the under $2 million the previous year that they spent on marketing and advertising. Heritage has been around for about 50 years or so now. Any idea why they have suddenly decided to jump into this entire anti-democracy campaign in such a big way, and where all of this money now seems to be flowing from?
Yeah, well, as the clip you played showed, these anti-democratic tendencies are not new among the far right and among the Heritage Foundation in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Heritage Action, the 501c4 arm of the Heritage Foundation, is relatively new. And, its creation and, its continued growth in recent years, has indicated that Heritage is willing to get more aggressive,
mm-hmm.
And wade more, wade into these policy fights more explicitly. But the media spending, I think that's an important piece to note, because Heritage Action's advocacy and its advocacy around voting rules was not limited to lobbying and not limited to drumming up grassroots support.
Mm-hmm.
It also spent millions of dollars on TV ads in 2021 to influence lawmakers and the public.
Mm-hmm.
It spent millions of dollars on TV ads supporting Georgia's law, urging the governor to sign it, and also after that law, after Georgia's restrictive voting law, triggered this backlash from businesses around the country. It was so controversial that Major League Baseball even moved the All-Star game from Georgia to Colorado in 2021. Well, Heritage Action, in response, spent well over $1 million on TV ads defending the law. They also, on the federal level, as Heritage Action was working to thwart the passage of H.R. 1, the big democracy reform bill, it spent millions of dollars on ads, or countless amounts on ads in states like West Virginia and Arizona, urging the then Democratic senators in those states to oppose reforming the filibuster, to allow democracy reform legislation to pass with a simple majority. So it's really become, Heritage Action has really become a powerhouse. Not only spending a lot of money on lobbying, but also spending a lot of money on TV ads in order to advance this anti-democratic agenda.
I had wanted to ask you about that, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Kirsten Sinema in Arizona, because this is critical. It's not just the effort in the states, it's also the efforts, the federal efforts, because, over the past 2 years, Democrats actually crafted two of the most significant and comprehensive voting rights and campaign finance reform measures that we have seen since the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That would be the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. They were combined into that H.R. 1 bill, a single measure. The U.S. House passed it when Democrats had control. Then it went to the Senate, and all 50 Senate Democrats said they were in favor of the measure, but just two of them, Sinema and Manchin, would not vote in favor of changing the anti-democratic filibuster rule in order to actually pass that, what would have been landmark legislation. So do we know if, in fact, those two then Democratic senators, Sinema has now become an independent, were they specifically targeted in a way that other senators weren't, or were their states specifically targeted in ways that others weren't, because Heritage knew they only had to flip, or I should say hang on to, one or both of those two supposed Democrats?
Right, right. Yeah, so protecting the filibuster was a major priority for Heritage Action in early 2021. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Heritage Action's executive director, Jessica Anderson, said on the video that we obtained that you played some snippets of at the beginning of the show. She said protecting the filibuster is an all-hands-on-deck moment, because if Democrats change the filibuster, then they are going to be able to enact H.R. 1, which not only is going to protect voting rights, but it's also going to end dark money.
Could
subject Heritage Action and groups like it to greater transparency. They would have to disclose their donors. So Heritage Action absolutely targeted Senator Sinema in Arizona and Senator Manchin in West Virginia. They did it with TV ads, and then in West Virginia in particular, they also did it with drummed up fake grassroots activity. Heritage Action and other groups organized buses from out of state, bus activists from out of state to West Virginia for a rally that they called that was intended to save the filibuster and to protect and to protest Manchin's potential openness to changing the filibuster rules. So absolutely, Heritage, the millions of dollars that Heritage Action spent in 2021 included substantial expenditures to pressure Manchin and Sinema in order to not reform the filibuster and thwart democracy reform legislation.
Of course, it wasn't them doing it. It was the grassroots. It was the people who were just, couldn't stand to see the filibuster changed. The audio that I played there from Jessica Anderson, the executive director of Heritage Action, it was supposedly a private donors conference, but it seemed like there was a whole bunch of people there. And it did not seem that she was embarrassed at all. I mean, surely she must have known that somebody was going to tape, or video record this or something. She does not seem embarrassed at all to boast that, her group is actually writing these bills for these state legislatures and then trying to pretend, to make them look like they have the grassroots bottom up vibe, as she described it. I mean, What does that tell us? That, you know, did she think this was going to stay private, or do these folks not really care anymore? Because ultimately, the next question here is, you know, is anything actually unlawful that they're doing?
Yeah. Well, you know, Heritage Action, you know, does not disguise the fact that it thinks that it believes in the lie that elections are susceptible to substantial fraud.
Mm-hmm.
They're not embarrassed about the fact that they're promoting restrictive voting bills, mm-hmm, that, you know, undermine the public's access to the ballot box.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jessica Anderson was perhaps a little bit more explicit when she thought she was speaking to a room full of donors than she might be if she was speaking in public.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, the thrust of what Anderson was describing on that private video is supported by, you know, public materials about Heritage Action's activities, including the tax filings that we obtained, as well as lobbying records on both the state and the federal level.
You write, Brendan Fisher, that the New York Times found that one-third of the 68 voting bills filed in Georgia in 2021 contained policy measures and language that aligned very closely with proposals from Heritage Action. So is that the direct result of this copy and paste, you know, so-called model legislation that is essentially handed to them by Heritage? Is that what we should presume from that?
We know that the policies that Heritage Action was promoting appeared in the restrictive bill enacted in Georgia and the other bills that were proposed in Georgia, and that Heritage Action was pouring substantial resources into Georgia legislation. There's also, you know, I think it should be noted, though, that there are a number of other groups on the right that are also pouring substantial, mm-hmm, resources into restrictive voter legislation and in driving their far-right activists into the election space.
Mm-hmm.
So Heritage Action played an important role, but it did not necessarily play a singular role in restrictive voting bills in states like Georgia.
You also report the group had a hand, at least, in advancing 11 voting bills in at least 8 states in 2021. The big question here is anything that they are doing actually unlawful in any way, or are we just sort of exposing what they are doing and what the laws currently allow them to do, as appalling as it may be?
Yeah, there's nothing that I've seen of Heritage Action's activities with respect to promoting restrictive voting bills that violates the law. What Heritage Action is doing is taking using its substantial dark money resources in order to, you know, protect the broken political system and undermine the freedom to vote.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's ultimately what we're helping to expose and helping to inform the public about.
You know, in one sense, Brendan, I'm sort of jealous about all of this, what Heritage Action, their schemes, what they're able to do, what ALEC has long been able to do, the American Legislative Exchange Council, you know, to create these model laws for these various things that are then taken by Republicans, introduced as if they wrote them themselves back in their own state legislatures. The reason I say I'm jealous is, you know, if it's not actually unlawful, are there any similar progressive or Democratic groups who do the same thing, who produce this so-called model legislation that is then actually used by Democratic lawmakers around the country? And if so, is it funded to the same sort of level that these right-wing groups are? And if not, should there be such groups?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, certainly there are a number of groups on the Democratic side or the progressive side, you know, that have helped to support legislation that would expand democracy and make it easier, mm-hmm, for people to vote. And I think that's ultimately what's at issue here. Are the bills that we're talking about,
mm-hmm,
and the policies that we're talking about, you know, going to expand access to democracy or restrict it?
Yeah, and I just don't, and whether it's democracy or anything else that progressives and Democrats care about, I just don't get the sense that there is that same sort of political infrastructure you know, that we see on the right with so much money. Maybe it's there. I just don't know about it. And to some respect, I wish there was, not only to push for good progressive policies, you know, but to compete with what the Republicans are doing and frankly have been doing for so long, to the point where you see in state after state, whether it's on, you know, voting, abortion, gun safety, you know, all down the line, we see the same bills passed over and over in state after state. And we don't see anything similar to that on the Democratic side, at least as far as I have been able to find. Brendan Fisher, in a separate matter here, on Tuesday this week, according to Roger Sullenberger at the Daily Beast, notorious Republican liar and freshman Congressman George Santos, quote, filed a flurry of amended campaign finance reports, telling the feds, among other things, that about $700,000 that he had claimed previously to have personally loaned to his own campaign didn't, in fact, actually come from his personal funds, as he had previously asserted in federal findings. Well, knock me over with a feather. You mean George Santos lied? Anyway, do we know where did that money come from? And if it was not from him, is that even lawful, since the new filings, you know, just say that, oh, this didn't come from me after all, but it doesn't tell us where it did come from?
Right. That's the big question. You know, where did George Santos's money come from? We still don't know, and George Santos isn't telling us. So just to back up a little bit, mm-hmm. you know, George Santos has a very troubled financial history. He's mm-hmm. been evicted from a number of apartments. News reports have indicated that he's left a long, long string of debts. When he ran for office in 2020, he disclosed that he earned no income in 2020 and just mm-hmm. a $55,000 salary the mm-hmm. year prior in 2019. But lo and behold, when he runs for office last year, in 2022, he discloses that his wealth has skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. And this company that he created in May 2021, so after he had already started running for office, had paid him around $1.75 million in both 2021 and 2022.
Mm-hmm.
So it's awfully questionable, awfully questionable whether this was a legitimate company, whether Santos actually generated, you know, legitimate revenue and income from this company, or whether that money was coming from some other source. Where it relates to his campaign is that a substantial amount of his campaign funds purportedly came from Santos himself.
Mm-hmm.
Over $700,000 of Santos's campaign funds, you know, were reported as personal loans from the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, where did that money come from? Did it come from this mysterious company that has no apparent clients? And if so, where did that company get its money from? You know, the amended reports last night do nothing to clarify this mystery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the around $625,000 of the loans that Santos claims to have made to his campaign now are still reported as candidate loans, but they've unchecked the box that says the funds were the personal funds of the candidate. So, you know, that may suggest that the money came from some other source, but we don't know what that source is. And all of this suggests a lot of illegality. There's a lot of potential campaign finance violations.
Other than the candidate themselves, who else could loan? I mean, isn't there campaign finance limits on anyone else making any sort of loans? The only person that can actually legally loan their own campaign that much money would have to be the candidate themselves, right?
Right. Well, the reason that box is on the form, because the loan is reported as having come from Santos himself, the reason that there's a separate box for whether these are the personal funds of the candidate is because a candidate could receive a bank loan and then use the proceeds from that bank loan to put into their campaign. You know, perhaps you take out a second mortgage on your home in order to finance a loan to your campaign. But if that's the case, you have to disclose the underlying loan, and it can really only be a bank loan. It can only be a loan from a financial institution. You can't get a loan from some individual or some corporation and then put that money into your campaign. That would be illegal. So basically, if if Santos, if the source of Santos's purported personal loan was anything other than his personal funds or a bank loan, then that money was illegal. And Santos did not disclose that any sort of a bank loan. Mm-hmm. So the inference is that Santos illegally used prohibited funds for his campaign.
So
we don't know because these reports are a complete mess.
Right.
And it can be really difficult to distinguish between Santos being incredibly sloppy and Santos being intentionally deceitful.
If it came from a corporation, a company, or even a person, a Russian oligarch, and said, "Here, George Santos, here's $700,000 that I am loaning you. Go ahead and loan it to your campaign. You can say it was a personal loan." That would wildly violate campaign finance laws. But I have a crazier question, Brendan, and I realize it's crazy, but given who we are dealing with, maybe it's not all that crazy. We all learned about Santos' story, his life of lies and so forth, and this $700,000 he supposedly personally loaned his campaign. But I have wondered, since hearing about this, if he actually did. In other words, if anyone actually did, do we know, Brendan, as one of the nation's foremost campaign finance experts, do we know for a fact that $700,000 was actually given to the campaign as opposed to just claimed on paper? And the reason I ask this is because, I'm sure you recall Ted Cruz went all the way to the Supreme Court to get a ruling that would allow people like him to loan his own campaign money and then have it paid back after the campaign by donors, which is really, the equivalent of out and out payoffs to elected officials, it seems to me. Is it possible that Santos simply made up that number of $700,000 in hopes of later receiving post-election campaign payoffs? Or is that a crazy idea?
Yeah, it's an interesting theory. And I think you're right that Santos was banking on Santos was anticipating that he would exploit the Ted Cruz decision from the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
Allowing him to continue repaying this purported personal loan well after his campaign ended, and to do it from lobbyists and other donors.
Right.
Which is
obscene on its own, by the way. Just want to make that clear. That Ted Cruz ruling is obscene on its own. But yes, please continue. Yes.
Yeah. It certainly appeared that his campaign needed the money. His campaign was spending money like crazy. We don't really know where a lot of the campaign money went. Much of the spending appeared to have been obscured through these odd $199.99 payments,
mm-hmm.
Just below the threshold by which the campaign would have to keep receipts
mm-hmm.
to actually verify that the money was spent in a legitimate way. So, it seemed that Santos's campaign needed the money both for legitimate campaign expenditures as well as potentially some illegitimate ones. So it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell, and it can be really difficult to know, how to interpret any marking on Santos's campaign finance reports because they are such a mess. Even before this scandal broke, the FEC was consistently asking the Santos campaign to amend its reports and fix a long list of errors. Many of these reports were amended multiple times, four or five, six times, and that's even before anyone knew about Santos's lies.
I got to get out, but I'm just laying down this marker. I would love someone to confirm one way or another that $700,000 that he actually claimed to loan to his campaign, no matter who it came from, I'm really wondering if it actually happened or if it was all on paper. It's crazy, I know, but we are talking about George Santos, and would it really be that crazy? Anyway, Brendan Fisher, Deputy Executive Director at Documented.net. Thank you, as always, for joining us, for your good work. Congratulations, by the way, on this important digging you're doing into the Heritage Foundation and their action committee. It's really critical. Thank you for shining a light on that. You can find his work at Documented.net. You can find them on Twitter at It's Documented. And you can find Brendan himself on Twitter as well, Brendan_Fisher. Thank you, my friend. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Okay, we do have to get out, but...
but wow.
Well, I know, and Des, I was actually hoping, and I know I sort of sprung it on him,
yeah.
But I was sort of hoping Brendan would say, well, no, that's ridiculous. Of course, if, you know, the FEC would have found this, they check the bank accounts, right? After someone claims they gave this much money to the campaign, they actually
yeah.
check to make sure that much money actually showed up in the campaign. He didn't say that.
No, he didn't. So, you know, I hope we'll find out that mm-hmm. that is, you know, an actual legitimate transfer of actual money, not just a thing on a piece of paper.
A legitimate illegal transaction, but it actually was a transaction. It actually happened. I don't know if it did or not. And I don't know. It sort of sounded like Brendan couldn't tell us for sure either
yeah,
at
but,
this point.
Yes, but I also want to speak to one yes. thing that he had mentioned that yes. is still larger picture of how Heritage Action is actually
yes.
Using all of this rich people money
yes.
to rig the system. And it just underscores the need to tax the rich, because it makes that case more and more that the rich and corporations, they get tax cuts from Republicans. They use those tax cuts, those new profits, to then rig the political system, use
yep.
dark money to pour into every election that they can to get more Republicans elected, to then get more tax cuts so that they can then rig the system even more.
And if you had any question about whether taxes need to be raised on these people, you just got to look at this jackass comedian, I guess he calls it, Stephen Crowder,
mm-hmm.
who was offered $50 million for 4 years of doing a 90-minute podcast show each day by
yeah.
These right wingers.
Where
just,
does all that money come from?
There is so much money on the right compared to what is on the non-right. It's obscene. Obviously, the wealthy have way too much money.
And
they
using
need
it.
To be taxed more. Yeah.
yeah,
and they are using it for nefarious purposes, unfortunately, to rig the system. You're right. Good point, Desi Doyen. Thank you very much. Desi Doyen is, of course, our producer. And my thanks to all of you as well for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it for free anytime, no paywall, at bradblog.com. While you're there, do consider hitting one of them donate buttons. We are 100% listener and reader supported. We could not survive without you. We thank you for that. And you can go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Twitters, and Mastodons, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
To the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.